Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you, Joanna. Well, it's a hard act to follow, I'll tell you. She made some of the points I was about to make, but that's all right. I won't hold you as long as I would have. Thank you for coming on such short notice. I just was at Yale, and the place was full. Yale. So, you know, I'm a Princetonian. What do you expect? When it comes to Yale, let me just start on this note. I think Joanna made the right ending here. This is, to use a cliche, this is a historic opportunity. We haven't had this opportunity for years to form a new political movement that has a very broad-gauged appeal. What really attracted me to the Green Party was how broad and deep its agenda is not, quote, just environment, although that's extremely important. It cuts right to the issues of labor, of consumer health and safety, of the distortion of our public budgets through military overspending, corporate welfare, to the preservation of a defense of its own people, known as the national jurisdiction, which shouldn't be usurped by WTO and NAFTA and other systems like that. And it increasingly is focusing on the tools of democracy. We can have all the rights on the statute books. We got to have tools. And I want to talk about some of this this evening. But I do want to dispel one myth here. And the question I'm always asked is, do I know that I may cost Al Gore the election? And to which I said, if that was at all of any concern to me, I never would have run as a candidate. Because you don't run you don't run to lose. You run to take as many votes as you can from all the other candidates, right? But here we are in October, and frightened liberals, and I've never met more frightened liberals than I've met this year, say with dread in their voice, do you know how bad George W. Bush is? And I say, compared to who? The man who fluctuates every day between being the great imposter and the great pretender, Al W. Gore? You know how you can tell how little difference there is? I know this will outrage some frightened liberals because they have their little list, which we'll get to in a moment. Make a list of all the departments and agencies of our federal government. Consider the growth of the permanent corporate government in Washington that I have and my colleagues have been fighting for years. They're represented by 22,000 full-time lobbyists. They're represented by 9,000 political action committees. There were 5,000 lobbyists in 1975 and 400 political action committees. They're represented by a Wall Street Washington shuttle where key figures become secretaries of Treasury and Commerce and other high government posts and in the Pentagon, and then after a few years of on-the-job training, they cycle back into higher positions in their corporations or trade associations. They represent 80% of the money in federal elections, corporate money. They pick and choose many of the nominees. They decide who they're going to oppose and who they're not going to oppose as a carrot stick factor over some of the better members of Congress in order to intimidate or inhibit them. And they basically want three things from Washington, these corporate lobbyists. They want poor or no enforcement of the laws against them, regulatory agencies, for example, Food and Drug, Auto Safety, FAA, OSHA, EPA. The second thing they want are government contracts and grants, hundreds of billions of dollars. And the third, what they want are subsidies. They want subsidies and immunization from liability for the harm and the looting and the plundering that they're engaged in. And so Washington is one giant accounts receivable for these corporate interests. And it doesn't really matter who is in the White House, whether it's a Gore or a Bush, except on the margins. You know, little idiosyncrasies that one president or another would have. Basically, Gore and Bush are frantically raising money from the same corporate interests in order to see who gets to live in the White House and take the marching orders from their corporate paymasters. That's what it's all about. Now, let's take the departments. Does anybody really think that the following departments will be different under one or the other? State Department, Defense Department, Treasury Department, Federal Reserve, Department of Commerce, Department of Agriculture, Department of Labor, GSA, Food and Drug Administration, you name it. There are little bits of differences in the Department of Interior, little bit of difference. The Republicans want to cut down all the forests in the national forest, and the Democrats want to grandfather all deals to cut down the trees in the forest. And in the area of EPA, a little bit of difference, nothing much to brag about, however. Better rhetoric. Now, this is where the beguiling factor comes in. Do the Democrats have better rhetoric than the Republicans? Yes. They speak differently, but do they do differently? And if they do differently, how much do they fight for the doing differently? That's the difference between them. I'll give you a simple example that probably you're not very concerned about. D.C. statehood, Washington, D.C. The people in D.C., the people in the District of Columbia, of course, have no vote for any representation in Congress. No senators, no representatives. The only capital of any country in the world that allows people to vote that does not have the right to vote for members of the legislature or parliament. For years, the Democratic Party has stood fair square behind D.C. statehood. For years, the Republican Party has stood against D.C. statehood. For years, the Republican Party has done everything possible to make sure nothing happens for D.C. statehood. And for years, the Democratic Party has done everything possible to make sure nothing happens in D.C. statehood. So how different are they really? Other than take your choice. Do you prefer a provocateur or an anesthetizer? Which one would organize you more? Would it be a sweet-talking snake charmer like William Jefferson Clinton? Or would it be someone like Secretary of Interior James Watt under Reagan, who managed to so provoke the environmental groups that many of them doubled and tripled their membership? And they got a backbone, which many of them don't have now because it's the anesthetizer. It's Al Gore saying, I'm for the environment. I'm for the people. They're for the powerful. If only words would have a biological effect, Al Gore would have a forked tongue and a Pinocchio nose. Let's take an area that some frightened liberals may say is really different. Civil rights. Now, there's a real distinction between the two parties. You know, I've been around quite a few years. I'm sick and tired of Democratic Party rhetoric on this. I'm sick and tired of these white liberals going into black churches and getting just in the right cadence as they give them that good old rock'em sock'em civil rights talk, huh? And then they leave and betray them day after day. They love to do that. They got it down, Al Gore and Bill Clinton. Do they love to speak in black churches? They love to use the language and the cadence. How disgustingly pontifical when they go back to their office and don't do a thing about 200,000 black kids who are poisoned by lead-based paint peeling off tenement walls. When they do nothing about skyrocketing, never-before-reached levels of child asthma due to incinerators and other pollution that is called environmental racism. 5 incinerators in Hartford. Guess where they are? You think they're in the shrubbered suburbs? No way. They don't do anything about child poverty except talk about it. And in fact, lately, they don't even talk about poverty. Al Gore's wind-up speech in Boston, he says, I'm going to represent middle-class families. Oh, middle-class, isn't that nice? Middle-class families. How about 47 million workers in this country? One out of every three. One out of every three American workers who do not make a living wage, who are not part of the middle class because they are not paid for their just work. They don't get just rewards for their just work. Let's take you back to 1968. Not at Columbia. That was one hot year at Columbia. 1968, let's say you're 1968 now, and somebody says to you, I got a crystal ball. The purchasing power value of the federal minimum wage in 1968 was $7.30. That's the purchasing power today. Was adjusted. Okay, that's what people were able to buy in purchasing power, the equivalent of $7.30 today. And someone told you that by the year 2000, the economy will have doubled in real terms per capita, in terms of output. And then asked you, what do you think the purchasing power of a federal minimum wage should be now? Would it be too radical to say it should be about $14.50? You know what it is? It's $5.15 today. You see how people are falling behind? And 10 million Americans are at minimum wage. 70% of them are not teenagers. And then tens of millions more, $6, $7, $8, Walmart, McDonald's, Burger King. And then they got to work longer hours. And more members of the family got to work for these low wages to try to make ends meet. And then they can't. And so they got to go into debt. And there's $6.2 trillion in consumer debt outstanding in our country during a boom economy. And the savings rate last month just dropped below zero. It's the lowest in the Western world. Other countries have 5, 10, 15% savings rate. Below zero. People are spending more than they're earning because they can't make ends meet. And they can't make ends meet because the very costs of going to work have skyrocketed. You've got to commute longer, another used car, another insurance policy, another repair bill, more daycare expenses. Who's going to pay for grandmother who's sick and ailing? There isn't health insurance to cover the family, even though she may be on Medicare. It's a torment. It's frantic. It's the year 2000 AD. What are we doing? Who designed this economy other than greedy corporations who dominate our government? Whenever corporations are given too much power, the society suffers. They've got to be kept in their place. They've got to be given boundaries because that commercial instinct knows no boundaries other than what's imposed on it. Every major religion in the world, going back 2,000 years or more, has pointed out that one society after another should be careful about giving the mercantile interest, the commercial interest, too much power because it's so singularly driven with that monetized mind that's so highly motivated that when it collides with other value systems, justice, health, safety, democratic processes, respect for childhood, respect for future generations, due process, when it collides, it runs roughshod. It corrodes, it destroys, it undermines these value systems. That's why the Bible referred to mammon the way it did. These were not revealed truths, they were everyday experience. 2,000 or more years ago, still true today, and certainly bolstered by many of our forebears' wise observations. One being Justice of Supreme Court Louis Brandeis, 1941, put it very pithily. He said, quote, we can have a democratic society, or we can have the concentration of great wealth in the hands of the few. We cannot have both, end quote. It's even truer today. There's a greater concentration of power and wealth in fewer and fewer global corporate hands that are merging almost by the week into fewer and fewer giant corporate conglomerates that are astride the globe, unchallenged by any countervailing power, with governments as minions, deep in debt to IMF or World Bank or other chancellors of the exchequers in the Western world, and corporations that now command the labor, the capital, the technology and more governmental power. And not satisfied with controlling national governments, the architects of WTO and NAFTA have developed an international system of autocratic governance contrary to our due process, our open courts, our public dockets, and subordinating our proposed or existing health and safety standards to challenge by other countries who can say, your auto standards are too tough, your food labeling standards, your pesticide standards are too tough, you're restricting imports into your country from our country, and that is GATT or NAFTA illegal, and we're going to take you to Geneva, where the courts under the WTO are closed to everybody. There is no public transcript. There is no independent appeal. And if we lose, as we've lost 5 out of 5 challenges to our environmental regulations already, if we lose, we have to either repeal our law or regulation or pay economic fines to the winning country ad infinitum until we're in compliance. And why would we lose? Because WTO and NAFTA is an instrument of giant corporations to depress costs and to depress standards, which is the same thing. And in so doing, the countries that treat their people better are more vulnerable to challenges by countries that don't treat their people so well, accusing us of erecting these health and safety laws as a way of imposing non-tariff trade barriers on their exports to our country. Pretty interesting scheme, huh? When Clinton and Gore pushed this through Congress under a fast-track procedure, which meant no amendments allowed on the floor of the House and Senate, which meant limited debate. The House debated its pay raise in that period longer hours than it debated GATT. And under these autocratic procedures, it is not surprising that they produced autocratic systems of governance. And so we are losing on the installment plan more and more of our local, state, and national sovereignty. In fact, we gave up more of our local, state, and national sovereignty under NAFTA and GATT WTO than any legislation in American history. It wasn't that there was no opposition. Public opinion polls showed more against than for, and there was a global trade watch coalition of unions and environmental, consumer, church, human rights groups. They were not up to the combined power of the Clinton-Gore White House and the big business establishment. And so when you get this concentration of power, here's what happens. Number one, our expectation levels are controlled. You think you have high expectation levels as a young generation? You've got one of the most absurdly low expectation levels of any generation in history. Your main expectation level is to get a darn good job where you can be a law-abiding citizen and go through life essentially on your knees as long as you're remunerated for it. And if you don't believe it, look at the Columbia University graduates of 10, 20, 30 years ago. Ask, where are they now? Where are they now? Huh? You can't say, look, we all grow up corporate. If you grow up corporate, you grow up with low expectation levels. Let me give you a personal vignette. When I was a youngster, I prided myself in spotting the models of cars as they went by. I said, hey, this is a Chevrolet, this is a Pontiac. I had gone to the 1939 World's Fair here in New York City, and GM had the biggest exhibition. It was something like Futurama, it was called. And it had all kinds of different electric vehicles and turbine vehicles and all these things they projected in the future, which we still don't have from General Motors, by the way, as the internal combustion engine moves into its second century. And here I was, a little boy running to my parents, excited, shouting, GM, GM, GM. Little did they know at the time, of course. I would hitchhike to college and law school. I found transportation very dull, so I wanted a little excitement. You always learn something. Someone picked you up as a bricklayer or a tree surgeon or doctor, and you know, you got a lecture free. No interruptions, no cell phones in those days. And we would often come on to some pretty grisly accidents, crashes. Especially one I remember between Hartford and Boston, which was a ricochet multi-rear end type crash, and you couldn't believe the bloodshed, the moaning, the dying groans, and one little child virtually decapitated. And that got me interested in how cars crumpled in a crash, and I did a paper at Harvard Law School on it, which was turned into the book Unsafe at Any Speed. But what was most interesting is that my own evolution was, how could I have looked at cars the way General Motors wanted me to look at them? Answer, that's all the advertisements were. Auto company, that's how we looked at cars. We couldn't see what they could be like, because they were not advertised or reported in terms of what they could be like, in terms of fuel efficiency, pollution control, crashworthiness, and so on. As a result, it was a liberation. I was beginning to grow up civic, looking at cars the way they should be looked at, from a functional standpoint, on behalf of the interests of motorists, pedestrians, communities, and balanced transportation with public transit. So I it might be said I moved from growing up corporate to growing up civic. Now, you can test yourself very easily. When I use the following words, crime, violence, welfare, regulation, what comes into your mind? You've been programmed. It's street crime. It's war or violence in the streets. It is poor people lined up for welfare checks. And it's government regulation. Now, look at those words empirically. By any criteria, more people in this country are killed, injured, subject to disease by corporate crime and violence than street crime, bad as street crime are. Now, you might say, that's outrageous. Where is my evidence? Just look at 60 Minutes from time to time, 2020, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, AP, Business Week. It's all there. Nothing happens, though. The reports are there. 2 weeks ago, Business Week had a cover story, September 11th, Business Week, and the cover story was, too much corporate power? Question mark. And inside, page after devastating page of detail, showing that the answer of Business Week magazine, remember, these editors from Business Week do not read Karl Marx on their lunch break. The answer was yes. And the editorial accompanying this remarkable copy, although Business Week had done a lot of investigative reports on corporate abuses in the past, the editorial said, quote, corporations should get out of politics, end quote, the exact words. So Business Week magazine now is to the left of the Democratic Party. Far to the left of the Democratic Party. Let's run them through. 19,000 homicides last year, far too many, in the streets, etc., and homes and so on. 19,000, all right? 65,000 people die every year from air pollution, preventable. 100,000 people die every year from exposure to occupational hazards, particulates, toxics, and trauma. Most of it's preventable. 80,000 Americans die every year, according to the Harvard School of Public Health study, from gross malpractice in the hospitals. Preventable. How many are attributable to the tobacco drug lords? It takes two to produce that kind of result. The addictor, tobacco companies, and the addictees. And when the drug companies figure out that if they can hook 11, 12, 13, 14-year-olds, that they can hook them much more easily, aren't they for some of the 400,000 deaths from tobacco-related diseases? And how about the Delcon Shield, which was mutilating hundreds of thousands of women here and abroad? And the company knew about it and covered it up, along with its A.H. Robbins company, along with the Aetna insurance company that was its insurer. And then how about just theft of property? You think bank robbers take away loot? They're pikers. How about this? Just in terms of your health care dollar, 10% goes down the drain due to billing, fraud, and abuse. Just billing. This is even before they put the whites on, and the hospitals and all. This is billing, fraud, and abuse. That's $110 billion last year. General Accounting Office, U.S. Congress is the source. No, you keep going. Well, how about welfare? Poverty welfare is modest compared to corporate welfare. These guys really know how to do it. When they get on there, there's no five-year cutoff period. There are no accusations of reducing the will to work. These are the mineral companies who get your gold, molybdenum, copper, silver, free for $5 an acre. A Canadian company got $9 billion of our gold on federal land in Nevada a few years ago, went to Washington under the 1872 Mining Act. The government had to sell it for $30,000, $5 an acre. The pharmaceutical industries, who brag about their great innovation and how they have to charge you such high world-class prices because they plow so much back into research, they get a huge amount of the drugs free from the U.S. government. Government R&D, National Institutes of Health. You heard of Taxol? You heard of AZT? Your tax dollars developed those, tested them. Then they were given away under government policy to Bristol-Myers Squibb in the case of Taxol, who is now charging a woman with ovarian cancer $14,000 for 6 treatments. No price restraint imposed by the government? And if the woman couldn't pay, she goes on Medicaid and the taxpayer pays Bristol-Myers at the other end. No royalties back to the government. This year, Bristol-Myers will gross $1.1 billion revenue from Taxol, and it took $31 million of your tax dollars at the National Cancer Institute to discover and human test that drug, and it was given to Bristol-Myers. This goes on all the time, corporate welfare. Agribusiness, corporate welfare. You name it. I've just come out with a little book, Seven Stories Press, here in New York City, called Cutting Corporate Welfare. It is at least over $200 billion a year just at the federal level. Never mind at the city level, where tax dollars pour into building stadiums, ballparks, and arenas while schools, clinics, drinking water systems, and public transit systems starve for lack of repair. And corporate regulation? You ever hear of corporate regulation of your lives? Well, look, let me give you an example. You think the government regulates you compared to corporations? They could never come close. Who knows more about your personal lives, corporations or government? The corporations know about your credit card history, your buying, what you buy, what you don't buy, your medical records. They're moving into your genetic records, financial records, you name it. They have profiles on you. They credit you with a score. You've got a number. You know, you go into the credit card economy, you're credit scored. And if you don't score right, they don't sell you. Or they overcharge you. And it's a number. We're supposed to be a democracy. Nobody puts a number on us like that. Corporations do. They know more about your genetics and your personal privacy. It's just starting. And what do you think all that fine print is? Any law students here? Law students? Huh? There's a law student, huh? Well, let me tell you, there was a survey of law professors a few years ago, and the question was, do you read the fine print of those standard form contracts that you sign on the dotted line? And most of them said, of course not. Now, you know why? It's not because they didn't have a magnifying glass. It's not because they didn't understand the technical jargon. It's because they understood that even if they read it, they couldn't do anything about it. Because these companies are private legislatures. They basically set the standard form contract, and you take it or leave it. You sign on the dotted line. If you don't, you go across the street, and the same auto dealer with another logo company on its name, it presents the same auto dealer contract right in front of you. It's written by the same law firm, probably. Have some fun someday. Next time you go down to buy something, like from Sears or from an auto dealer, or you buy auto insurance or a landlord's lease, just ask them when they give you the standard form contract if you can sit down and read it. You know, give them tell them something like, your mommy and daddy always told you never to sign anything you didn't read. Right? And you sit down, and there are things you don't like. You know, you double the warranty here, cross out a paragraph there. Delete the binding arbitration provision which strips you of your right to go to court if you have a dispute with the bank or the insurance company. And you got it all ready, you initial it, you know, it's like you're taught to. And you bring it back to the salesperson and you say, here, sign on the dotted line, we got a deal. See what happens. And so we wrote a book once, an action manual for lemon owners, and we had a pro-consumer car purchasing agreement. And we urged people, and the next time they buy a car, they go down to the dealer. And when they pick out the car, they slap this down and say, sign it online. Fellow writes us, he said, you know, I did exactly what you said. I went down to the dealer, picked out a car. The dealer was shuffling the papers and trying to, you know, get all the things that I was supposed to sign. I said, excuse me, I think I'd like you to sign this contract. You know what the dealer did? He called the cops. It's corporate. That fine print is corporate regulation. But, of course, we would never study this at university, would we? Are there any corporate crime courses at most law schools? Don't have corporate crime courses. They don't have courses on corporate welfare. You don't study corporate power. Maybe there's one course at Columbia entitled Corporate Power, you know, taught by a professor on her way out. So, no. Universities are increasingly corporatized, Research priorities are shaped by corporate money, moonlighting by professors. Do you ever have your professors disclose all their moonlighting activities? I mean, wouldn't you know what your professors are doing by night when they teach you by day? Huh? Which companies they're consulting, which companies they're working for? That might be a nice project for the daily newspaper here, the college newspaper. Huh? Last I heard, Columbia professors are paid full-time for a full-time job. Maybe they can take one day off a week, the way Harvard lets professors take off one day. I'm sure that's fully complied with by some professors. At Stanford, professors aren't satisfied even if they can double their pay with corporate consultantships in certain departments. Do you know about this? What's going on here? What's going on is increasingly the defiant, the dissenting professors are being crowded out. They're being disciplined. They're not getting tenure. And with the drive to get rid of tenure altogether, there's not going to be that much freedom of speech in the academy in the coming years unless something is done about it. All right, just very briefly, here is what happens when there's too much power in the hands of the few who decide for the many. One, we don't have public funding of public elections. We have rich people funding of public elections. A fraction of 1% of the richest people fund our elections. So if we want to get cash register politics out of elections, we have to shift power through a new political party, for example, from the few to the many, so the many can build the political pressure for public funding of public elections. Once we remove that big boulder on the highway to progress, then other things will begin to happen that haven't been happening. For example, we're the only Western country that doesn't provide universal health insurance for all its people. Western Europe did it out of war-torn World War II in the 50s and 60s. Why haven't we? We're the only Western country that has such a high level of child labor, 20%. Deep poverty, another 20% near poverty. Just think of that. 40% of our children are growing up in impoverished conditions, 40%. And some Western European countries have essentially abolished child poverty. It's down to 2%. You know, Netherlands, Scandinavia, what's our excuse? Other Western countries have provided paid maternity leave, adequate, full pay sick leave for themselves and their immediate families, adequate pensions, far easier rights to form trade unions. We don't have those. The richest country in the world. Because we never went through a trade union expansion and a social democratic political movement that they did in those critical years after World War II in Western Europe and Canada to provide their people with these kinds of safety nets. And the result has been horrific. It's a huge amount of pain and poverty and deprivation in this country. It just doesn't get on the late nightly evening TV news, does it? And what is the TV news that you see in New York? You know, the evening news? It's 30 minutes, isn't it? 9 minutes of ads. It starts out with 3 or 4 street crimes just to get warmed up, very superficially covered. Then you get the first weather tease. something's coming to New York on a weekend. We'll tell you. And then you get maybe one or two serious stories from City Hall or whatever, and then you get a little chit-chat between the anchors, and then the second weather comes on, obsession with the weather, Doppler radar, all kinds of meteorologists. Where do they get these people? There's one new one every 2 days on the same station. And they start with a storm gathering over the Cascades, heading for Montana, rolling into the Great Plains, over the Alleghenies, coming in from western New York. And then if they want to waste more of your time, they'll show all the suburbs around New York that are 4 miles apart, 71 degrees here, 73 degrees there. And then if you want to waste more of your time, say 20 years ago it was 74 degrees. It was a record. And then after 4 minutes of weather, literally, 4 minutes of sports. And then maybe the animal story is always a nice animal story. And maybe something out of the New England Journal of Medicine. And then they have the nerve to tell you at the end that this is what happened in New York City today. And all the citizen groups and neighborhood groups and cultural and creative and labor and business, all this, that doesn't matter. It doesn't qualify. Because you know what the principle is for late night evening news? You know what guides what's going on? It's called, if it bleeds, it leads. That's the format. If it bleeds, it leads. And it's your property. And when power is concentrated in the hands of the few, you do not control the public airways that you legally own. You're the landlords. The radio and TV stations are your tenants. They pay you no money whatsoever for rent to the Federal Communications Commission, and haven't since it started in 1920s as the Federal Radio Commission. They've had over 70 years of free use, tens of billions of dollars of free use of our airwaves. Now, if power shifts, what will happen is we will become more likely to have our own radio and TV stations and cable channels, and it will be properly funded. You know why? Because we will be charging these radio and TV stations rent, and that money will come be cycled back into a people's media with adequate reporters and producers and production facilities without the suppression of advertisers and other censorious influences. And so people who work hard in Brooklyn and Bronx try to improve affordable housing, public transit, community policing, trying to deprive the powers that be from the exploitation in the ghettos, rent-to-own rackets and payday loans and so forth, they'll be able to communicate this to a large audience to help mobilize, giving phone numbers and addresses and so on. See what I mean? Low expectation levels. Let me ask you. How many students in this audience ever thought the following thought? We are part of 15 million college, community college, and graduate students in the United States. We do not have one 30-minute weekly over-the-air national television program about what's happening on college campuses other than sports. Isn't that interesting? You ever think of that? I never thought of that. It never occurred to me when I was your age. I was growing up corporate. Just the way you were. When power is concentrated, you can have a majority of workers making less today in real dollars and working harder than 20 years ago, even though there's been massive gross economic growth since. Here you have massive economic growth, which is not solving the problem of health insurance, of poverty, of inadequate public transit, of decent allocation of public budgets so that human need prevails over corporate greed. It is not solving the problems that really afflict people. It's not improving our educational facilities and our core curriculum so our students, starting in grade school, learn citizen skills, learn the realities of the community under adult supervision, learn how to practice democracy, learn how to reflect the lessons and wisdom of history, and then as a byproduct learn reading, writing, and arithmetic. That isn't any focus on that. What happens when we have too much power in too few hands is that our democracy is so weakened that it cannot do its work. It cannot solve the systemic problems. It cannot prevent the systemic solutions. The old story that without people, nothing is possible, but without institutions, nothing is lasting. Without community, there is crisis. Without democracy, all these things deteriorate, and we're deprived. And just think how badly we are deprived. Here we are in a country that should have no poverty, that shouldn't have to require people almost every waking hour during the week going back and forth from work, absent from children, from family, from civic community activities, going frantically trying to make ends meet and slipping behind in spite of a booming economy. People say, you know, these are not the times for bold new political movements. I say these are the times for bold political movements, because when an economy demonstrates that it can continually grow at 4 and 5% a year and still leave most of its people behind, still let 20% of its children grow up in deep poverty and 20 more percent in near poverty, still can neglect environmental devastation and contamination of air, water, and soil and food, can still deprive the nation of repairing its public facilities, can still control people's expectation level, that's when you want a major new progressive political movement to rise from the hearts and minds of the American people. Because the rich and the powerful can't tell you, well, let's grow the economy, it's a recession, what do you expect? They are growing the economy. You know, capitalism is great for generating wealth, not to mention its external destructive effects like pollution, but it is lousy at generating justice. Democracy is what builds the middle class and generates justice. We can't leave our democracy to the generators of wealth who reserve such an extraordinary portion of that wealth for themselves. The 1% of the richest people in this country have net wealth equal to the net wealth of the bottom 95%. You have the world's expert on wealth distribution nearby here, NYU, Professor Wolf, for reference. And to make it worse, what do you think of this one? And what does it make you think of when you think of this one? The bottom 40% of the poorest Americans, 120 million people and children, have net wealth equal to that of Bill Gates in January of this year. Now, does your attention quickly move to that great software imitator in Redmond, Washington? Or does it move to the following observation of millions of workers in those categories who have worked year after year, decade after decade, and are dead broke? Assets minus liabilities. They're working paycheck to paycheck plus increasing consumer debt. And if they're really poor and people of color, they're working for payday loan to payday loan at 2, 3, 400% rollover interest rates by the loan sharks. Shift of power is what this election's all about. Historically, every social justice movement was marked by a similar theme. The haves of great power had to give up some of it to the non-haves. And this is where the Republicans and Democrats are essentially the same. They have no interest and no strategy in shifting power. The Democrats and the Republicans are avoiding taking a stand on repealing the notorious anti-labor union Taft-Hartley Act of 1947, for example. That would open the way for labor law reform that would allow tens of millions of workers to form democratic trade unions in places like Walmart, Kmart, McDonald's, and other forms to raise their standard to a livable wage. Neither Democrats and Republicans really have a corporate crime enforcement policy. If you ask Bush and Gore, what is your corporate crime enforcement policy? Look at their website. It's not there. What's their policy on the massive diversion of tax dollars in an upward redistribution of wealth that we call corporate welfare? Subsidies, giveaways, handouts. Not there on their website. How about campaign finance reform? One talks a little better than the other. Both of them refuse, in their own words, to unilaterally disarm. Well, if the Democrats refuse to unilaterally disarm until the Republicans refuse to unilaterally disarm, until they agree to unilaterally disarm, and if the Republicans refuse to unilaterally disarm until the Democrats agree to unilaterally disarm, Where does that leave us? It leaves us where it's left us. Year after year, rhetoric and nothing to show for it in terms of taking out dirty money from politics. Now, here is the Green Party, because it wants to practice what it preaches and preach what it practices, has unilaterally disarmed to set an example for those two corrupt political parties. And hopefully, one day, the New York Times editorials, which regularly condemn corruption of money in politics, might find just one little paragraph in order to say, and look at the Green Party, they're not taking PAC money, they're not taking dirty soft money, they're not taking corporate interest money, they're just taking funds from individuals such as yourself, and they're setting an example by unilaterally disarming. That's what we want to do. It's easier to practice what you preach in order to preach what you practice by not looking over your shoulder and saying, well, but the other fellow's not doing it, so why should I? We are also campaigning with citizen groups on the ground who are struggling for all kinds of justice from the bottom up, from the ghettos to the corporate suites, from the precincts to Congress, from environment to poverty to racism, from the kind of devastation that is being inflicted on our small farmers and the destruction of rural life as we know it, and a boom economy, from the people's desires not to spend a quarter of their life commuting back and forth in Southern California and trying to get some more elevated mass transit, from the living wage drives all over the country whose picket lines we have joined, and with Winona LaDuke, moving forward on a whole variety of modern subversions of equitable civil rights and civil liberty laws. Civil rights, civil liberties. Are the Democrats different? How many of you read the 30 articles by Anthony Lewis in New York Times condemning as abysmal the Clinton administration's civil liberties record, among the worst in modern American history? There's an eye-opener for you, from habeas corpus to the mistreatment of people who come to this country in terms of lacking due process and immediate deportation. That's a nice lesson in American due process. Clinton was behind this, right with the Republicans. How about civil rights? Civil rights lawyers in the Justice Department have told us that in 2 out of 3 litigation enforcement areas, affirmative action and illegal police violence, the Clinton administration's record is worse than Reagan-Bush. Only in anti-housing discrimination is the Clinton administration record better than Reagan-Bush. And so what appears to be is not. We have two parties converging one another and morphing into one corporate party with two heads nourished by the same corporate interests who go to both of their fundraisers, fill their tables, drink their wine, and write the checks to the two parties. And we can, of course, go through life picking the least of the worst. In 1,000 years, if we just have two parties in our country, I guarantee you, one will be slightly worse than the other. And if you go to the polls with a least worst attitude, you will indeed be legitimizing that which you decry. And they'll never look back and thank you, as both parties will get worse every 4 years. But aha, the Supreme Court, I hear from a frightened liberal. But it is the Supreme Court, says some of the Nation magazine editors. Never mind massive, booming military spending and weapons traffic that the USA is using your tax dollars to fund on behalf of Lockheed Martin and Boeing and Raytheon and Grumman and Northrop. Never mind that we have a military budget that is as high as it was in the height of the Cold War. Never mind that the Soviet Union demised 10 years ago, and we have no known major enemy as we thrust ourselves on China with our major corporations in a fit of a crypto-communist capitalist devolution in that. Never mind that we are spending hundreds of billions of dollars instead of back home to alleviate the pain and anguish and deprivation of people all over the country who are being shortchanged because their tax dollars are going into F-22 futuristic planes and Seawolf submarines and decoyable missile defense boondoggles and Osprey fighters and others that people in the Pentagon don't even want, much less retired admirals and generals who've been speaking out against this. Never mind, you know, that we still have a foreign policy that both parties are identical on, just as they weigh on military spending. That's what they're arguing, how much more military spending. And this foreign policy, is that going to be different under Bush or Gore? Aren't we going to continue to support dictatorships and oligarchs and arm them and have economic deals with them and IMF and World Bank deals with them standing square tall behind democratic forces in the third world and supporting workers and peasants for a change? You think that it's going to be different under Gore and Bush? Huh? Not going to be any more different than a number of letters in their names. No difference whatsoever. Aha, but the Supreme Court, the frightened nation editor liberal says, you don't understand. A whole generation of Americans may be under the thumb of a Republican president nominees to the Supreme Court, to whom I respond, who are the two worst justices? Frightened liberal. Frightened liberal responds, Scalia and Clarence Thomas. And I respond to the frightened liberal, do you know what the vote was in the Senate to confirm the dreaded Anton Scalia, who never hid his views one moment in the confirmation hearings? The vote was 98-0, and the only two absentees were Republicans. Senator Gore and all Democrats voted for Scalia. How about now Clarence Thomas, nominated by George Bush? He won 52-48 after the Anita Hill hearings with 11 Democrats taking him over the top in a Senate controlled by the Democratic majority leader, George Mitchell. And I was there right to the end, and I saw that he did not, and the other Democrats did not move forcefully to get those 2-3 more votes that they needed. So, frightened liberal, provide me with some scintilla of credibility for your clairvoyance into the future, and tell me how terrible these justices were. Warren, Brennan, Stevens, Blackmun, and Souter, all Republican nominees. And didn't you really like that dissent by Whizzer White, Jack Kennedy's nominee, in Roe versus Wade? And didn't you really like the anti-regulatory philosophy expressed by Stephen Breyer, who was such a wonderful candidate nominated by Clinton, that Senator Hatch, rock-ribbed right-wing Republican, said, he'd have been my choice too, as he sailed through the Senate? How low is our expectation level of our political system and politics? I say too low for the future of this country. Our country is more important than their fundraisers. Our country is more important than the time we are unable to give it, because we are otherwise predisposed. Young people come up to me and in their sophisticated cynicism say, I'm not turned on politics. And I say, look at history and heed it. Because if you're not turned on politics, down to the air you breathe, the water you drink, the racial profiling you detest, the health insurance your family may not have, if you're not turned on to politics, politics will surely turn on you. Then, the Democrats in our country have become exceedingly good in electing very bad Republicans. They have lost our Congress to the extreme wing of the Republican Party, headed by Newt Gingrich, Trent Lott, Tom DeLay, and Dick Armey, some of the most craven, avaricious, cruel legislators to ever crawl up Capitol Hill. And it was the Democratic Party in its decaying state, remote from its historical mission of countervailing corporate power, that allowed our Congress in 94, 96, 98, to come under the Republican control. And when I hear Democrats say, you got to support us because of that Republican Congress, I say, I'm looking at the parents of that Republican Congress, the people who made those Republicans possible, the people who abandoned the tradition of the Democratic Party back to Jefferson. And are they possibly able to internally reform themselves? I've been waiting a long time. Years and years, and it keeps getting worse. Because they expressed their victories over Republicans by saying, we took away some of their issues and became more like them. That's why we beat the Republicans. And when they lose to the Republicans, they don't say it's because we turned our back on progressive Democrats, the soul of the party. It's because they say we didn't take enough issues away from the Republicans and weren't enough like them. Well, the choice between the bad and the worst is not a good enough choice in the year 2000. And if you're interested in building a progressive political party with your talent, your energy, your foresight, your excitement about what a political party can be like that comes out of the minds and hearts of the American people, where you can run for office yourself, local, state, national, you can organize, strategize, canvass, you can build a party that on November 7th will get surely millions of votes and move to building that party to even stronger positions in the near future. And right after November 7th, there will emerge from this election a strong third party that will be a watchdog saying to the other two parties in Washington, you're either going to shape up for the American people or you're going to shrink down, and the Green Party will get even more of your votes in future elections. And that, my friends, is a clear win from this Green Party effort in the year 2000. That watchdog function. You will see the equation and the dynamics inside the Democratic Party change very rapidly indeed. It does seem that people in one generation after another can be divided in two parts. One part thinks the things are going to remain as they are no matter what they do. It's the you can't fight City Hall syndrome, the you can't fight Exxon syndrome. It's the que sera, sera syndrome. Another part, often much smaller, are the pioneers, the people who say, our forebears sacrificed so many things to bring our country to the level of justice where it's at now. Think of being an anti-slavery abolitionist in Mississippi in 1840. Think of that. If you were caught, you were lynched. The cotton plantations owned human beings as slaves. You think the abolitionists looked at slavery and said, you know, those cotton plantations are powerful. They got powerful people in state and federal legislature. They have the police on their side. They have the bloodhounds on their side. Why don't we go easy? Why don't we just push for abolition of slavery for all slaves over 65? When you look at what our forebears sacrificed in the coal mines and steel mills and textile mills, what the civil rights strugglers sacrificed, what they gave up, what they ended up losing for prevailing another day for those who survived them, how can we look at ourselves and say that we don't want to be a generation that has to give up so little in order to achieve so much? Civic motivation comes from three sources. One, the heroics of our ancestors and forebears. Two, our own sense of empathy, our own cultivated sense of injustice, which higher education should raise to even higher levels of cultivation. And three, our respect for posterity, for future generations. Take your pick. One, two, three. Two out of three. Three out of three. Raise the estimate of your own significance, and let's work together to build this party in the next 4 weeks or so with your friends, your neighbors, your relatives, your fellow students. Start replacing small talk with progressive political talk of gravity, of moment, the kind of talk that brings us together into addressing our immediate grievances and developing systems of justice to shape the future of our country and what it can be for the rest of the world. It's either the corporations who are going to plan our future, or it's going to be the people. As Saul Alinsky once said, the great Chicago organizer, the only way you're going to fight organized money is with organized people. And indeed, this is the essential struggle. Whether major corporations that are not human beings, that are artificial legal entities, with all the rights that we have as real human beings, except the Fifth Amendment under our Constitution. They're considered persons under our Constitution. And with all the privileges and immunities that we can never have, because we're not artificial entities. We can't be in 1,000 places around the world at once. We can't fool around with subsidiaries to guide our misdeeds or create our parents through holding companies or diffuse our responsibility for harm done vertically or horizontally in these giant corporate bureaucracies. We can't shift costs the way they can onto innocent people. We can't deduct our trips to lobby Congress as citizens, but corporations can. There are many differences, including the ability of corporations now to hold patent rights and life forms under biotechnology. Every day these corporations are planning our future, our biological future, our political future, our economic future, and not in the least, our cultural future. Our corporate commercial culture is displacing the creativity of popular culture in a homogenized, standardized gel type of corporate commercialism. And so I urge that in the next 4 weeks you bring out clusters of voters among your own circle of friends and co-workers, relatives and fellow students. Bring them down, have breakfast on election day, hold civic house parties, restore the word of mouth, the most credible, fastest form of communication, because it's from friend to friend and student to student, relative to relative. And you'll see that once you shift power in America from the many to the, from the few to the many, you will see a remarkably expeditious assault on our injustices and serious problems, a remarkably expeditious application of solutions ready to roll for problems that we don't deserve to have. You will see a flowering of creativity, of initiative from grassroots communities and neighborhoods up to Washington. You will see those groups in Washington you send $25 to a year, your environmental, women's rights, civil rights, anti-poverty, labor, consumer groups. You'll see that they will have more power after November with every vote that goes to the Green Party. Because the Green Party is the way to say to the Democratic Party, never again are you going to tell millions of progressive people in this country that they have nowhere to go other than to stay home at on election day. They have nowhere to go other than to vote for a decaying, corporatized Democratic Party because the Republicans are a little worse. Isn't that what they have been telling us? It seems it's always the younger generation that takes the first steps. They are the most risk-taking generation. The anti-war efforts, civil rights efforts, environmental efforts in the 60s and 70s had more than a proportional share of young people on the front lines. And it's up to you now to take your hand at the wheel of justice. It's your generation's time. And we have proposed and provided this opportunity for you so you can take up the cudgels of leadership. We have opened some pathways for you so you can broaden those pathways. We have suggested you can apply your knowledge to civic action and the pursuits of justice. And we know that you are up to it if you just think you're up to it. You won't be up to it if you don't think you're up to it. The young generation in every period of history is the one that we rely on to advance the level of justice which Daniel Webster called the great work of human beings on earth, and to define once again free freedom the way Cicero defined it over 2,000 years ago when he wrote, quote, "Freedom is participation in power," end quote. You are part of the contented classes in America. You will go into the top 5% or 3% income levels pretty quickly. Even if you come out with debts, it won't take you long with a Columbia degree. And as part of the contented classes, you are able to look over the misery of the world, the wretched nature of so many billions of people wallowing in disease and poverty and destroyed expectations and illiteracy and brutality. You will be able to witness that and escape it because you'll be able to exit rather than participate. That's your choice. Maybe that choice won't be for long. With global infectious diseases and nuclear proliferation and global warming and all the rest on the horizon. But for the time being, you will be able to escape it. You don't like the public schools? Private schools. You don't like public transit? Air-conditioned transportation on the wheels. You don't like the situation in the inner city? You certainly don't have to live there. You can exit again and again and again. So it's up to you whether you're going to lock arms with the rest of humanity and provide your influence and talent and knowledge so that you can make a difference in this world, or whether you're going to spend the next 15,000 days, a little over 2,000 weeks before you turn 65, simply making more of it. Simply making more of it. Simply making more of it. And then ending up in retirement with an empty feeling in your stomach. That feeling that comes from people who have materially succeeded in life but missed the justice train when it was going out of the station. That's your choice. Think about it. You won't have that much time after you graduate. You've got a lot of time for elective thinking. You've got your own gathering places here at Columbia, your own libraries, your own databases, your own laboratories, your skilled faculty. You've got idealism. You can double up your courses and your civic studies at the same time. You've got a great deal of assets you will never have after you graduate. You've got your own newspaper, your own radio station. You're not likely to have that after you graduate. Assemble all those assets, and you'll be able to look back on your university years as not only years where you did your studies properly and got good grades, but years when you became a steadfast, self-assured, and confident citizen in a democracy, a citizen who knows how to connect with other citizens in order to no longer tolerate the shameful conditions that our world is exposed to. Thank you.